The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Conley, Judge Smith, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone. And I'd say welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, but I guess I should say welcome to your living rooms or conference rooms or bathrooms or wherever you might be this morning. For the sake of the record, I'll indicate, as the parties are aware, that we are not all present at the Minnesota Judicial Center, but we are holding this oral argument through the Zoom online tool because of the pandemic restrictions on our activity at the Judicial Center. But we are keeping an audio recording of the proceeding. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of the argument, just as if you were present, so that later on, we'll be able to attach each counsel to the argument that you're presenting today. If there's any technical glitches along the way, as I'm sure we're all familiar with in our experience using this sort of technology, it may or may not be apparent to others. If it looks as if you're having a hard time either hearing or seeing anyone, just wave your hand or alert me somehow, and we'll pause the proceedings to make sure that everybody is actually still connected. Please, as I said before, state your name as you commence each leg of the argument. Otherwise, the rules remain the same. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument, with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for a rebuttal. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, please do.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, my name is William Skolnick, and I'm appearing here this morning in place of my law partner and daughter, Amy Joyce, who's battling cancer and her chemotherapy schedule does not permit her to make this argument. We represent the appellant, Mr. Jeffrey Buchanan. As this panel is aware, these issues have been before you and your peers previously. This case involves a marriage lasting just under 11 years and after almost 20 years of paying annual spousal maintenance that started at $145,000 per year, and after cost of living adjustments is now $190,000 a year, now totaling that the recipient has received approximately $3 million over that time period, there are now substantial changes that took place after the divorce, including the fact that Mr. Buchanan's business became even more successful.
Just to be clear, that $3 million was a result of an agreement between the parties, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
All right.
And now, after his business became even more successful, he sold his business and at age 68 has retired. The trial court abused its discretion, as this court had found in its previous review of the matter, that a district court abuses its discretion regarding maintenance if the findings of fact are unsupported by the record. And the trial court here did that. They abused the trial court abused its discretion by ignoring and not considering the evidence that it was presented with. Let's start by looking at paragraph 14, where the court's analysis and conclusions, it states that Mr. Buchanan failed to establish a substantial change in circumstances that would allow the court to even consider whether maintenance should be modified. Then gratuitously, the trial court stated that even if Mr. Buchanan had established a significant change, the court would not find it unfair or reasonable.
Why would that be gratuitous? When I look at the record, it looks as if the district court found that both parties, well, the findings as to expenses and income would result in both parties having an increase in expenses of roughly 28% over the stipulated amount of expenses. So given that and some of the other circumstances, but that in particular, why is it that it would be unfair and unreasonable to continue the agreement of the parties?
Let me address that. Let's just take two items. You looked at expenses, and we're trying to get to the 20% threshold. take two items. Number one, the court now, the district court did say, okay, you're right. Now she receives Social Security. It's $1,365 a month. In addition, rather than a $5,000 a month home payment, her rent is $2,800. So that saves her $2,200 plus $1,365. Just those two items amounts to a substantial change in excess of 20%. But the court glosses over that.
I'm not talking about the change in circumstances. I'm going to the heart of the argument that you made a minute ago, that the district court was gratuitous and saying, well, even if there had been a change in circumstances, it's not unfair and unreasonable to continue with the current agreement. And it seems to me that if both parties are afforded about a 28% increase in their expenses, that seems at least to argue on the equitable side of things that the court wasn't totally out of bounds in saying that it would be fair and reasonable to continue. And disabuse me of that proposition.
Okay, I will. So let's look at where the court made what I consider, where the court clearly didn't pay attention to the evidence. Look at paragraph 15 and 16 of the trial court's findings of fact. Those demonstrate that the trial court failed to review and properly consider the evidence, but instead relied on the court's suspicion. So where did the trial court abuse its discretion? Where the court in that paragraph 15 says, and quotes, although the husband has the burden to establish his change of income, he chose to provide no underlying brokerage or investment statements to support his self-declared assets. His lack of full disclosure and other evidence presented strongly suggests that he has more assets and income. First, that's false. That's not true. That is not what the record shows. The court said that it relied on Mitchell Hiley, the expert for Ms. Hammond, for his analysis. And yet, Mr. Hiley in his affidavit at paragraph 2 says, and I quote, in order to prepare this affidavit, I was provided with Mr. Buchanan's pleadings in support of his motion, as well as tax returns, account statements, budgets, and various other financial documents. So the idea that somehow the court has this, says, well, he hasn't been fully, hasn't fully disclosed, all that information was provided, and the court states that it relied on Mr. Hiley. And here's what the court says. Mr. Hiley said that after tax of the $15,000 in spousal maintenance, it only costs him $8,700. To compound that problem, the court went on in that same paragraph to say husband received total income of more than $22 million. And yet on May 31, 2018, he declared his net worth was only $12 million. His declared living expenses cannot account for what happened to the additional $10 million over his current declared net worth. Very likely, he has assets that have not been revealed to the court, but the court has no evidence to firmly support that suspicion. Now, what happened to that $10 million? Well, if she had actually, had the court actually applied Mr. Hiley, who says in his affidavit and was used by the trial court that Mr. Buchanan's tax rate was at the highest federal and state tax rate account, which amounts to 46.85%. So take $22 million in income, apply the tax rate, and it's, you know, guess what?
Mr. Skolnick, I did, on that point, and I'm sure we'll all be checking the record. Is it true or not true that your client did not disclose how much money he made from the sale of his business?
There was a that is true, because there was a protective order, confidentiality order.
Do you not think that plays some role in the court's decision as to, you know, the information that was provided to it in terms of determining, you know, what his status is in terms of income?
No, I don't, because he did provide his tax returns to Mr. Hiley, which shows what income he had.
Well, you know, there was some reference in the documents in the briefs that he was providing some own statement he generated. Could you enlighten us on what that is and how that relates to?
Yes, Mr. Buchanan submitted his own declaration with some of his own financial information, including projections, income. Obviously, he couldn't disclose the details of the sale, but he did provide it. But on this so record,
these are his own numbers that he came up with.
He provided under penalty of perjury statements.
Of course, no one ever lies in court. I've never seen that happen in my life.
Well, I have.
So,
I understand the point.
Where did he get these? I mean, he provided his own statements, and were those based on these, you know, the similar documents you're saying that were provided to Ms. Chafee's client's expert? I mean, is that what we should be looking at? Because, I mean,
yes.
What I got, and I follow up on Judge Ross's excellent question, and I have been on this case before. You know, I do have some concerns as to, you know, the reliability of the information provided by your client. And I think, you know, that's reflected in the district court's orders. And I guess it's up to you now to explain why everything he sent and, you know, was absolutely on the up and up.
These tax returns, account statements, and financial information that Mr. Hiley was provided to Ms. Hammond's attorneys, her counsel. This is not something where we played hide the ball. It's not something where we're asking the court take our word for it. And this is the information that Mitchell Hiley, their expert, had and reviewed. And in fact, the court acknowledged in its decision there were certain determinations made by Mr. Hiley and claimed to rely on it. Well, if you apply the tax,
Counsel, before you get into the tax, I'm trying to understand why we're talking about this, and maybe I'm confused. Are you trying to talk about the tax returns in order to ascertain income at the time of the J&D? Are you talking about income at the time of the motion to modify? And we just spent a lot of time on paragraph 15, which to me seems to be to figure out his net worth, as I understand it, in order to determine what type of investment income he is earning currently. And so it was looking at net worth currently, which a district court found to be around then 12 million, although it couldn't understand why it was so low given how much he was earning. I don't really understand where we're heading in terms of the overall analysis of the comparing the alleged substantial change in income.
Okay, so the court clearly demonstrated that the court deviated from the record in front of it, that the state, the conclusions that were drawn by the trial court are not supported by the evidence. When the trial court says, well, he made 22 million and he claims he only has 12, and you know, that appears to me to be a bunch of hooey. Well,
didn't the district court determine the investment income on the basis of 12, even though it was suspicious why it's so low? I mean, isn't that what that paragraph 15 is talking about? What's the problem of the court's skepticism in paragraph 15 in terms of deriving the number of his current income?
I believe it permeates the court. What you can see is it permeates the court's view of the case and the evidence in front of it. This court remanded it to her, and the district court really obviously was going to know it. We're not making any changes. And then it appears, and I think we argued in our brief, that the court ignored the evidence to reach its predetermined result, which was that she was not going to modify spousal maintenance. She was not going to
skepticism isn't a reason to reverse. A district court can be skeptical if, in fact, the findings have some basis in the evidence. So what finding in particular are you complaining about? The findings about current income, the findings about income at the time of the J&D? What particular finding that makes a mathematical difference in measuring substantial change should we be focusing on?
All right. As I pointed out previously, there are the two sources of income. There are many others, the Social Security and the fact that her rent went down. That alone is a change where her expenses go down. We talked at the court previously, we talked about the adult child expenses.
Okay, so you're focusing on expenses now. That's fine. If that's it, do you not have a complaint about income for husband? That's what I thought paragraph 15 is about. That's what I'm trying to figure out. What's your income complaint in particular, mathematically? What's the error by the district court?
The income on which, in terms of my client or in terms of the respondent?
Your client.
My client was making a salary of $400,000 at the time of the divorce. In addition, if you add the expenses he was paying and the divorce decree says and business income, then you go up after the divorce, he sells his business, he no longer is earning $400,000 a year, he's no longer earning the $700,000 a year. And Mr. Hiley, again, Ms. Hammond's expert says, yes, he did go down to $120,000 as a consultant, and now here we are. That is a substantial change in Mr. Buchanan's income. As to the respondent's income.
So if I might interrupt, so I think it's paragraph 18 where the court decides that his income presently is $426,000 a year. I think that's what that paragraph 18 is about.
Yes, and if you look,
is that an error in your view? Is he current? Is the 426 currently an error?
I think if you look at paragraph 17, I see I only have a few seconds left. I think that it shows that it was 480,000 at a minimum at the time of the divorce, and I'm sorry at now. After he retired, I apologize for that mistake. And I think I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Skolnick. You will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. I'm Rebecca Chafee on behalf of Marcia Hammond, respondent and cross appellant based on her conditional cross appeal. May it please the court and counsel. Minnesota case law informs us that in order for appellant to prevail on his motion to decrease his spousal maintenance, he had a dual burden to meet. He not only needed to demonstrate that there was a substantial change in circumstances, but he also had to show that the existing award of spousal maintenance was unreasonable and unfair. Appellant failed to carry his dual burden. The standard of review before this court is an abuse of discretion. In assessing whether there has been an abuse of discretion, the court reviews whether the district court's findings are supported by the record, which they are, whether there's been an application or misapplication of the law, and there has not been, or whether the district court has made a clearly erroneous conclusion that is against the logic and facts on the record, which it did not.
Can I take you, if I can interrupt you for just a moment, please, and take you back to stipulation regarding Mr. Buchanan's income at the time of the divorce. And I'm speaking specifically about the $400,000 income plus return on the business asset. Help me to understand how the district court properly accounted for the additional, not the $400,000, but the return on the business asset. In other words, there was extra income that wasn't accounted for in the $400,000. Help me to see how the district court properly analyzed the extra income, whatever it was.
Well, I think what's really challenging about the judgment and decree is that there isn't a specific amount of additional business income listed.
But we don't know what we know it's something.
Well, so in this case, though, the burden is on the appellant to demonstrate what that amount was, and the appellant.
Well, can I pause you for just a moment? Would you agree that it must have been something?
I agree that it very well could have been a dollar. It could have been $100. We just don't know exactly what that amount was. And because it is the appellant's burden of proof to demonstrate that substantial change in circumstance, I think the district court did the best it could based on the information that was presented to it in finding that the income was $400,000. Appellant was represented by counsel.
So zero. So it's your view that it would be appropriate for the district court to say, to treat that language, not including return on business, on the business asset, as nothing, as opposed to drawing some reasonable inferences and coming up with some number.
Well, in some ways, the return could have been a negative number. So I do think that in determining that there isn't a specific number that the district court could memorialize based on the lack of information, then finding that the income at the time of the divorce decree is $400,000 is the best information and the best evidence that was before it.
Can you address Mr. Skolnick's argument that there were records relied upon by your client's expert from which the district court would necessarily have had to infer that the number could not have been zero?
Well, I don't think there were records relied upon by Mr. Hiley to say that the number was anything other than zero. The information that Mr. Hiley had available to him was the same information that the district court had available to it. Mr. Hiley did not have any additional information beyond the pleadings that were submitted by the appellant, as well as the related tax returns that supported the information that the district court considered. In this case, for whatever reasons, appellant did not provide proof of the actual income that he had received at the time of the decree. And I think, the district court pointed out in one of its footnotes that in Mr. Buchanan's situation, his tax returns didn't always line up with the amount of income he was asserting. So for example, in 2015, he asserted that his income was $700,000, and yet his 2015 tax return reflected a W-2 wage of only $550,000. So I think it was a troubling record for the district court to try to determine what the actual numbers were. And when the burden of proof is on the movement, then it is his responsibility to present the information in a way that the district court can understand it and that's clear. And without presenting that information in that clear way, I think the district court's finding of $400,000 is supported by the record. With regard to the other issues that the district court addressed on remand, the district court clearly addressed my client's budget. As the remand directed, she specifically considered the evidence before the court as to whether or not any expenditures were being made toward the party's adult child. In fact, the district court decreased my client's budget accordingly and made a reduction of $375 per month for her budget.
Can I jump in just one more moment? Can you address the whether the district court clearly erred in finding your client's income amount? And specifically, I'd like you to address the additional Social Security income and the housing expense reduction.
With regard to my client's income, the district court found that there was an 11% increase in her income compared with the time of the entry of the decree. $2,193 per month was the investment income that the district court found was existing at the time of the decree based on her investable assets. $2,413 per month was the amount of the investment income currently or based at the time of the motion hearing. That was a $220 per month increase in her income. So I think it's reasonable to find that that is not a substantial increase in income. The additional increase in income that the district court found was $1,365 per month in Social Security income. Now, that was certainly an amount of income, or Social Security income is certainly an expected income that the party certainly knew that my client would receive one day. She had a working history. The parties were married for more than 10 years that would have allowed her to take Social Security on Mr. Buchanan's income if it was so appropriate. So the Social Security income was always an expected income that would have been received by my client one day. And Minnesota case law tells us that an insubstantial increase in income does not necessarily mandate any change in the spousal maintenance award. So the Borchert case and the Halverson case are two cases, published opinions from the Court of Appeals, that are directly on point to this issue. In the Borchert case, we were dealing with much smaller amounts of income, but the income increase for the obligee in that case was a 40% increase in her income. And the district court found that that was not a substantial change in circumstance and did not render the original award unreasonable and unfair. And the Court of Appeals in Borchert affirmed the district court's decision, saying, yes, the district court did not abuse its discretion in making those findings. Similarly, in Halverson, the increase was even more substantial from a percentage perspective because the obligee was earning virtually nothing at the time of the decree, and by the time of the motion for modification was earning over $19,676, which is more in absolute terms than the amount of the increase that the district court found in this case. So Halverson, which was a case from 1987, had a greater increase in income. And the Halverson case found again that that was not a substantial change in circumstances that rendered the original award of spousal maintenance unreasonable and unfair. So the district court really followed the case law in finding, yes, there had been this insubstantial change in my client's income, but it wasn't sufficient as she looked through the rest of the evidence to find that such an award should change based on that expected Social Security income that my client was to receive. I would also note that at the time of the motion hearing, my client had not yet received that Social Security income. And so there had not yet been any calculation regarding taxes that would be on the Social Security income. So that was not a part of the court's record or finding at that time. With regard to each of the criticisms that the appellant raises in his brief and in his oral argument, really the district, appellant is asking this court to reweigh the evidence. And I won't belabor the point because I know that this court is well aware that its role is an error correcting court, not to reweigh the evidence and to make different judgments than the district court did regarding its findings. Each of the findings with regard to income, with regard to expenses, is supported in the record. The appellant does not point to any of those factors that is not based in the record, although it's very clear that appellant wishes that a different decision had been made.
Can you explain why we should not be concerned with the contention that on remand, the district court had simply already reached a conclusion previously and was going to and did adjust its findings only to support its conclusion rather than going from the front end and making findings from which it made its legal determination?
Well, I don't know that there's any evidence of that whatsoever. I do think that as the district court issued its 18-page order with over 66 paragraphs, 47 of which were findings of fact, the district court very much looked at each of the factors. Ultimately, and I think the district court did state this in its August 2018 order, it did find that even though there might be a substantial change in circumstance, on the whole, in the entire context of this case, even if it could be found to be a substantial change in circumstance on any one of these factors, this stipulated judgment and decree should not be modified with regard to the spousal maintenance because of the overall fairness and reasonableness of the original order. So I do think the district court certainly had a view of this case because it had very extensively looked at the record and made its findings, but it went through each of the factors and ultimately laid out in detail why it thought the weight of the stipulation for this voluntary agreement of permanent spousal maintenance really mattered a lot. And I think this is at the heart of this case in particular, in that these agreements that are reached in divorces are very complex, and there are many different issues and compromises that go into cases in determining whether or not a permanent maintenance award should be set or whether what the amount should be. So the district court was very careful to say, I am not in a position, because there isn't a substantial change in circumstance, to cherry pick this particular issue and to disrupt what was no doubt a part of an overall comprehensive agreement that the parties had thoughtfully reached with legal counsel some years ago. And really, the fact that Mr. Buchanan has complied with the agreement and that the payments have been made is what should occur. And so I think that's certainly something that appellant has argued as a reason for perhaps changing his maintenance now, but him complying with the agreement is what he was
supposed to do. If I can jump in and press you on one point. I mean, we do have these agreements that occasionally are clear about modification, where the parties are waiving any right to modify, and it doesn't appear that was the actual argument that was made in the district court. Are you making that argument now, that there was an implied waiver of the opportunity and right to modify if there were a change in circumstances, and leaving the agreement unreasonable and unfair?
No, not at all. There's not a cure and waiver in this situation, and I'm not arguing that there is one. I'm simply.
But what's your point about there having been an agreement then?
That the case law tells us, and the district court found that the court should be very careful and cautious and judicious in determining whether a modification should occur when there is a stipulated judgment and decree. So the district court followed the case law regarding the consideration of the stipulation when assessing the motion for modification.
Thank you. Unless there are any other questions from our panel, doesn't appear to be any. Your time has expired, and we'll move on to any rebuttal.
Thank you. The question that was asked was, what about the housing expense? Because it did go down $2,200. And what we, as further evidence to show that it was the trial court that ignored the evidence, not supported. The trial court made a note that even though Ms. Hammond decided to keep the house, she wound up selling it at a loss. What the district court didn't focus on or didn't mention or didn't consider is that Ms. Hammond's affidavit that she submitted, at paragraph 6, she said it ended up being a horrible financial decision for me to keep the house. And then even more important, at paragraph 15 of her affidavit, Ms. Hammond says, oh, by the way, I refinanced the home twice and withdrew the equity. Who bears the responsibility for whatever decision she made to keep the home or not keep the home, whether there was a mistake or whether she would have made a windfall? That's at her feet. But the court ignored the fact that she had refinanced, taken out hundreds of thousands of dollars of equity, and said, well, she lost money selling the house. And one of the expenses this court on remand asked the court to look at, we talked about storage fees. They never had a storage unit during the marriage, which we argued wasn't a standard, the marital standard. She put some items in a storage unit at $370 a month in 2011 when she sold the home. They've been there for 9 years. Is it reasonable? It's not part of the marital standard. And she said, well, she had a bigger house. Well, yes, but she made the decision what house to live in. And she made a decision rather than to do something with those items stored in storage to keep them for 9 years.
So it sounds like you're arguing that we're not talking about the marital standard of living, but actual use of funds that are available under a generalized standard of living, upper middle class, middle class, whatever. Why would we fly spec the decisions of an individual recipient or obligor of spousal maintenance just because they're doing something that's different if what they're doing is consistent with the standard of living?
Yeah, and I'm not asking the court to fly spec. We have certain expenses that the trial court and this court are looking at, saying, were they reasonable? Does that amount to a substantial change? Here's an obvious one. There was no storage unit. She's kept it for 9 years and hasn't done anything with it. Second item, another expense, the adult child expense. Ms. Hammond testified in her deposition that 25 to 30% of some of these expenses were for her adult son. And the court then went back and said, well, yeah, but 300 and some bucks a month is all we're going to get it. So it accepts Ms. Hammond's testimony on some items and then totally ignores it when it comes to a specific expense for adult children, which this court has clearly established is not appropriate. So we have the housing expense. And by the way, the adult child expense was approximately $1,000 a month, not 300. Then we've talked about the adult child. We talked about the housing expense. I also, just to make sure we're clear, the trial court did not, we made a request to supplement the record after remand, and the court refused our request to supplement the record, which is what, of course, would have been helpful in light of the, I believe, the remand order. We're not asking the court here to do anything other than apply the law.
But you're not, just to be clear, your appeal doesn't challenge as an abuse of discretion the decision regarding whether to reopen the record. That's not before us, is it?
No, I want to be clear, but there was some confusion about why didn't Mr. Buchanan or somebody else, you know, put some information in the record. We attempted to, and it wasn't. That is not an issue on appeal. You are correct. In conclusion, what I would say is that when you look at the record and you look at these expenses, you can't just ignore them and say it's okay. Between these items of income, the decrease in expenses, it's clear that there's been a substantial change that requires a modification. What I would ask the court to do is to remand this case and with instructions as to have another judge appointed to hear it. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. The matter is submitted and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you for your argument, both Ms. Chaffee and Mr. Skolnick, both in brief and the oral argument. And Mr. Skolnick, very sorry to hear about the circumstances of your having to argue today. And we hope everything goes very well with your daughter. Matter is under advisement and we will recess for the next case. Thank you.
Thank you.